And tonight on Coast to Coast, a special 2 hours as we talk about lost civilizations, secrets of the past with our special guest, Oberon Zell, back with us. It's been about 4 years, so get ready for this Coast to Coast ride. We'll be back in a moment. Well, welcome back to Coast. Let's talk a little bit about Oberon Zell, a transpersonal psychologist, a metaphysician, a naturalist, a theologian, author, artist, teacher, puppet, a playwright. He's almost got all those titles. And those who know him well, though, consider him to be a true wizard. And also, he's an expert in witchcraft, and he holds academic degrees in sociology, anthropology, clinical psychology, teaching theology, has a number of books out there. His most recent, Lost Civilization, Secrets of the Past. Welcome back to Coast, Oberon Zell. Been a long time, Oberon. How are you?
Hey, George, I'm okay. How are you?
Good. Looking forward to this.
All right.
A little bit of Harry Potter and a little bit of everything else, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, when you've been doing it as long as I have, you just sort of keep adding more things to the collection.
How did you get involved in this entire field?
Well, I've always been interested in the arcane, the areas that most people don't know about, the stuff off the map where there's blank spaces and it says, here be dragons, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, when I was a little kid, my very first reading was children's versions of the Greek myths, and I just kept going from there. And, you know, I got interested in fantasy and science fiction, and there was all these fascinating legends and stuff of mysterious creatures and lost civilizations like Atlantis and things. So, that, you know, it's just always fascinated me. I think that's one of the things about wizardry. It's all about that stuff that most people don't really know about, you know, so the arcane lore, as it were.
Wizards. When I think of wizards, I think of magicians, and I think of guys that are coming up with their own spells and potions. Is that accurate?
Well, it is to a great extent. The amazing thing about wizards is that the archetypes and the all the images that come down from the stories are really fairly accurate. They really depict pretty much what wizardry is all about. I mean, we have a wizard, basically, the word means wisdom, wizardry. A wizard tradition is just a wise one. And it's like a scientist means a person of knowledge, because science is knowledge. And philosophy is love of wisdom. So a philosopher is pretty much like a wizard, too. It's not a religious title, which is something that a lot of people don't seem to understand. So we have wizards of all religions and traditions, people like Moses and Solomon and Jesus and Leonardo da Vinci and many of the people that come down to a legend.
Was Merlin a wizard?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. I mean, he was described as the last druid, and druids were definitely wizards of their time. You know?
Tell me about your Grace School of Wizardry.
Well, that's been one of the neatest things I've been involved in. I'm just so delighted with that. It really opened almost 8 years ago now. We set up a 7-year program in 2004, and so we now have already our first graduates. And it's an online school of true wizardry, the wisdom of the ages, really, is what it's about. We have 16 different departments that cover everything from healing and psychic arts to divination and alchemy and ceremonial magic and even dark arts, all that stuff.
This is Harry Potter.
Well, it's sort of like if Hogwarts was a real school and really teaching real magic, this is the stuff it would be teaching. You know? But of course, it's just a story, which is nice. It's a wonderful story, and we all enjoy it. All the magical people I know really love the Harry Potter stories, but we also know that they're just stories, but they're set in this school. And they're set in our world, which is what makes it so fascinating, because most of the stories of magic and wizardry are like, you know, you can't get there from here in another galaxy far, far away, or somewhere over the rainbow, or in an ancient lost world of Middle Earth, or through the magic wardrobe or something, you know. But the Harry Potter stories are set right in this world, and they say that there are real magical people that are just, you know, you just don't notice them. And that's actually true. So we all really enjoy it.
Oberon, tell me about the students who go to the Grace School. What are they looking for?
Well, we have students from all over the world. That's one of the nice things about being an online school, of course, is that our teachers and students are all over the world. We have right now about 850 some students, and they come, well, I think a lot of them probably started off, certainly the younger ones, although we have all ages from 11 to our oldest students are in their 70s. I think some of them come looking for the real magic behind the Harry Potter kind of stories. Stories of wizards have been a part of our culture for so long. There are every stories, you know, everywhere. So people look for that, and they also want to learn the magical arts, things that they hear about. They want to learn psychic arts. They want to learn how to do magic and cast spells and healings and herbcraft and divination and all that stuff. So we have all that. You know, we teach all that stuff.
What do the students get out of this when they're done?
Well, depending on what department they major in, they may be qualified to go into any number of fields. We have a special classes in each department that talk about what you can do, how you can take this, what you learn here, out into the mundane world. And there are all kinds of areas. Somebody who majors in, say, alchemy could go into any of the sciences, you know, chemistry, physics, even robotics and medicine.
Oh, that's
exciting.
Somebody
who majors in herbalism could go into herbal practice. Someone who majors in performance magic could go on the stage. We have a whole department that teaches the special effects magic of illusion and conjuration.
Are they physically at the school, or is it all internet-based?
No, it's all internet. There's no physical location at all. There's you know, our office at home. It's really my computer.
Sure.
And, of course, other computers networked. We have about 25 teachers that are quite
amazing. That's exciting.
Oh, yeah.
How long are the classes?
Well, they vary. The average class is 2 credits, and they're pretty much equivalent to what you would be getting if you took it
in a college.
Kind of a course in a college, right. Some of our short classes are only 1 credit, and some of the longer ones are 3 credits. Some of them go through whole seasons, like classes in gardening. You may have to be in there for months and months to go through the whole cycle. Other ones can be done fairly quickly. There's a great deal of variety, which is why there's different credits for different classes.
Let's talk then about some of the various aspects of being a wizard. Let's talk about healing, for example.
Oh, yeah.
Can they do that? I mean, do they have that ability to heal people? Healing, I guess?
Yes, we do. The hands-on kind of healing, the kind of healing that you see practiced in many healing modalities have become quite popular. Massage and acupuncture, acupressure. There's healing with light and with colors and with crystals, and quite a few of these are now being accepted into regular medicinal practice and even covered by various insurances. So, you know, This is really a practical kind of a thing. We do teach anatomy, of course, but various kinds of diseases to look out for. But we also, of course, say that, look, if somebody comes in with something that they need to go see a doctor, send them to the doctor, you know.
Sure. Absolutely. Right. Are they doing this, too, for, you know, relationships, maybe their own?
Absolutely, absolutely. One of our departments is the Department of Lifeways, and that's all about relationships and interactions. That's where all the psychology and the social things and interpersonal dynamics and counseling go. And it's really quite an important area because people come to a wizard. See, that's the thing, you know. That's when you're a wizard, people come to you expecting you to be able to answer their questions, to help them with what they need. They expect wise counsel. They expect good advice. They expect knowledge that they won't get anywhere else, just like you go to a doctor or a psychologist or a shrink, you know.
I would guess you do not teach, you do not dabble in black magic at all.
Well, we don't dabble in any of it, really, but we do have a Department of Dark Arts in which...
Oh, really?
Well, you have to learn defense against dark arts, you know. Just like in the Harry Potter.
So you're not trying to create evil people?
No. Au contraire. We really have to discuss it, though, and teach people
what
constitutes evil and how to deal with it and how to address it. In dark arts, it includes a lot of stuff. I mean, we have in there the whole area of the, things that go bump in the night. So we have classes about things like, you know, werewolves and vampires and ghosts and spooky stuff. And we teach that what is the reality and what is the fantasy and what is of all these things.
Where's that line, though, between reality and fantasy? It's pretty close,
you know,
isn't it?
It's in story. that's really where it is that everything that we are, everything we experience as human is stories. You know, really all of it, our entire culture, our language, our heritage, our everything we pass down, what we think of as knowledge and facts, it's all stories, creation myths and stories. And, I mean, the great wars that are fought and right now are fought over religious issues that are just stories. And everybody's got their own stories. And stories can bring us together, and stories can tear us apart. Stories can enlighten us, or they can, create misery. This is what the great storytellers of our time are putting these things out into movies. You get things like the Star Wars movies that were directly inspired by the hero's quest myth, you know? So that's really where the line is. It's in the stories.
Do you get people, Oberon, who come to you and they just need help? They want to change their persona and they just think this is one of the ways to do it?
Oh, yes, of course. Most people enter into fields like this first, just to straighten out their own lives. I mean, when I took psychology in college, I mean, the first thing I was really wanting to do was to learn about myself and how I worked and to try to get better and straighten things out.
Sure.
And after a while, you start learning how to understand others and how to help them, and it kind of grows out from there. But it usually starts with yourself, you know. Know thyself is what the motto was on the Delphic Oracle.
Well, and you have to know yourself, and you have to care about yourself because nobody else will initially.
Exactly. And if you don't love yourself, you can't love anyone else, really. You
know? That's a good
point. It all starts there. But you can't stop there. That's the whole trick. Yourself becomes the center of an ever-widening series of concentric circles that embrace those closer to you and further away, and eventually you can develop this really expansive view that is part of the wizardry teachings that embraces the entire universe, really, you know, that you expand out your area of concern.
What is it about magic, about spells that work?
Well, you have to understand the concept of magic in a way that I don't think most people quite get it. They think of it just sort of, you know, snap your fingers or wrinkle your nose and things happen. But magic is really, it's probability enhancement is the best way I can express it, is that we're always on the cusp of different sort of possibilities and probabilities. So many of the things that we engage in, not just obvious things like, you know, the lottery and gambling, but they're all a matter of probabilities. You know, there is no certainty. We like to think there's certainty, but you can, you know, be just doing everything right and driving down the street and somebody can just, you know, get drunk and smash into you, you know. So probability enhancement is a matter of shifting the probabilities of what's going on in a direction that's aligned with your intention and being conscious of that, taking your own consciousness in mind. And as we're understanding more about physics, especially the new theories of quantum physics, we're coming to understand things in which only the laws of magic really apply. And that's what's really fascinating, things like quantum entanglement that says that everything in the universe is connected to everything else, and that your consciousness actually changes what is being observed, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, that the observer shapes the observation. And there's just so much of that sort of thing. Even the medical placebo effect is one of those kinds of things. So we're always engaged in sort of shifting the probabilities and the odds one way or the other. In magic, the disciplines and the teachings teach you very specific ways to do that more effectively, really, by aligning in different ways with things, creating correspondences and associations. It's very effective. It works.
We're going to talk about your work, Lost Civilizations, in about 10 minutes or so. But you've also written a number of books about, of course, creatures. And tell me about that.
Oh, yes. Well, I've always had a love for fantastic creatures. That's one of the things that always got excited. When I was a little kid, I was a dino brat, and I really, really loved dinosaurs and stuff, and that kind of led into everything else, you know, dragons and beasties of all kinds. And so eventually, my wife and I kind of got it in our mind many years ago that we'd write a book on the true stories behind the myths, because that's what's always fascinated us. And in the process of our research, we discovered the secret of the unicorn, and it sort of diverted us because we ended up spending years actually raising unicorns. And then we eventually got back and wrote the book. And the book is now out, and it's called A Wizard's Bestiary.
Well, I thought unicorns were extinct.
Well, that's the interesting thing about it, is that they were never a natural animal, so becoming extinct isn't exactly how you describe it, as if it was some natural animal that died out. They were always created, and the secret of their creation is one that was discovered and lost and rediscovered a number of times throughout history, because it was always a very closely guarded magical secret, and we happen to be the people in this time who rediscovered it.
I like that. Now, what did these unicorns look like?
Well, if you've seen those tapestries that were done.
Oh, yeah, with the horn in the middle of the head?
Yeah, horn in the middle of the head, and the silken mane, and the cloven hooves, and the bearded chin, and the tufted tail, and the silky white coloring, and all that stuff. And that's exactly what they look like. They look like they walked right out of those tapestries.
How big are they?
Well,
like horses?
No, not that big. If you look at the tapestries again, you see them commonly, you know, lying in the laps of maidens and type of
they're
stuff.
They're kind of small.
They're kind of small. Well, their sizes can range from very small to medium size, I guess, sort of ranges. Well, it depends on the species of animal that is the progenitor. And that's the thing about unicorns. They can be produced from any number of horned species. It's like having an albino. It can be almost anything. It's just an albino, as it describes a quality.
Do you have them now?
Not anymore. The last ones that we have grew old and died. We created all of the ones that we did in the 1980s. Our first ones were born in 1980. And the very last one just died about 5 years ago or so. So that was it. That was the end of it.
Pictures on your website?
Oh, yes. Yes. In fact, there's a whole interview and lots of pictures on my website that's from the Circus Sideshow folks who just, we became sort of heroes to the Circus Sideshow people because they specialize in strange and exotic fabrications that are called gaffes, you know. But what we had was real, so they just, you know, it was a great little connection. In fact, we ended up leasing several of our unicorns to the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus.
That's amazing. You went to New Guinea looking for mermaids. What happened?
Yeah. Well, that was quite a thing, too. We heard after the unicorn deal with the circus, we had a little bit of money and some time on our hands, and we thought, well, what can we do next? And at that time, there were some reports coming out of New Guinea that were being reported in the Journal of the International Cryptozoological Society that we were members of that studies unknown and mysterious animals that are reported, like Bigfoot and Loch Ness Monster and things like that. And they were reporting sightings of these creatures that were identified with mermaids. The native word is pishmeri, which means fish woman, which is exactly what mermaid means, sea woman, literally. And so we decided to mount a diving expedition, and we did. We rented a dive boat, and we all learned scuba diving, and we hired a underwater film team that had worked on the movie The Deep, and we went off to New Guinea for the month of March in 1985. And it was quite an adventure, and we eventually did, in fact, find the creatures that were being so described. They certainly were not what we would like to think of as mermaids.
Were they seals?
No, they were Indo-Pacific dugong was the actual animal, and they were not very well known. They're very rare and endangered and very little seen, but the distinctive feature of them is that the females have breasts that look very much like those of humans. They're in the same position, and you know, they're nice round water balloon kind of breasts.
But it's
and
an
they
animal.
Have this beautiful tail. They have a tail like a whale. That's this beautiful wide flukes, and they live in the ocean. And so.
Well, now what does the face look like?
Homely. It looks very
homely. You wouldn't date it, right?
No, you wouldn't really date it unless you've been at sea for a long time.
I mean, does it look, you know, like a deformed human or more like an animal?
No, not well. That it actually looks. They're similar, distantly related to manatees, although not, I mean, the resemblance is like the resemblance between a sea lion and a walrus.
Okay.
They're not very close resemblance, but the face is basically designed to be kind of a vacuum cleaner to pick up stuff on the bottom. But if you look at it from a distance, the shape of the jaw as it is, and the general proportion.
Hold on for a second, O'Brien.
Hold
on for a second. I want to talk more about these mermaids in New Guinea. We'll be back. And with our special guest tonight, O'Brien Zell, as we talk about wizardry and some magic of creatures on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking magic, spells, wizardry, creatures, you name it, with O'Brien Zell here on Coast to Coast. We'll take your calls next hour. O'Brien, let's talk finally about these mermaids again before we move on to some other creatures. So do you think this is what the sailors of the past saw, and they, of course, came up with the mermaid myths?
Well, I think so from our investigations, George. But, you know, there's always other possibilities out there. I hate to ever tie off anything like this. There's always kind of open-ended mysteries out there somewhere. We know less about the oceans than we do about the surface of the moon, as has often been said. And there's another theory that's always intrigued us. In fact, it's part of why we decided to go there. And that's that there is a theory that all of our characteristics that make us human and distinguish us from the apes were acquired during a period that we were adapting to an ocean environment, to swimming. Our upright stature, the webbing between our fingers and toes, the loss of hair, the salt tears that we cry, a lot of our biochemistry, so many things. It's called the aquatic ape hypothesis. And the theory would be, if this is true, and I personally find the evidence compelling, I really believe this is the only thing that really does account for our distinctively human features, then it may be that not all of those creatures returned to land. And if that was the case, and some continued to live in the sea, they might have continued the same modifications that other animals that were aquatic came up with, like the sirenia, the dugongs, and seals, and penguins, and dolphins, and whales, and sea otters, and all these sea creatures that we know. They all adapted in certain ways to living in the sea. And if humans did the same thing, or early hominids did the same thing, then by this time they may very well have produced such creatures. But there is no real evidence for this that we know of, although there's certainly been some very intriguing speculation. But we carry in our own bodies the indication that we spent some considerable time there, enough to acquire modifications that we do not share with any of the other apes. So that was the other idea, mm-hmm. But that's not what we found. What we found were the dugongs, and the fact that the natives called them fish women because of the breasts was a pretty good clue. You know,
how do you spell that creature?
Pishmeri. It's P-I-S-H-M-E-R-I, and that's pigeon, New Guinea pigeon. The local names for them were Ilkai in one village and Ree in another that we went to, but the generic term was fish woman, Pishmeri.
Okay, we'll look those up. What do you think of Loch Ness Monster? What are your thoughts there?
Well, I have always been fascinated by that, and I think everybody is looking in the wrong direction. People keep wanting to see some kind of a prehistoric dinosaurian kind of a creature, like a plesiosaur or something.
Yes.
And that's just flat-out impossible, because...
Though we'd love it to be a dinosaur.
Yes, wouldn't we all? I would love more than anything to find living dinosaurs somewhere. I mean, there's rumors of the Mikilobimbi in Africa and the Congo swamps, and that's the best possible bet still going for that possibility of there still being a surviving dinosaur. But the Loch Ness Monster doesn't fit that at all, really, because you're talking about creatures that don't come up for air. They don't have to breathe air. And the dinosaurs and the sea reptiles, like the plesiosaurs, they live like seals. You know, they were constantly coming up for air all the time. You couldn't possibly not see them. But you're talking about something that is submerged most of the time, that's when it rises up vertically and sinks vertically, that has a neck and head proportions that are not really long like a plesiosaur, but more proportion like that of a horse, say. And you've got these things about the humps, which are pretty regularly repeated, plus descriptions of people who have seen them close up that invariably describe them as being slimy, having a skin that's kind of creepy, like crinkly, and little horns, antennae on their head. And what the description seems to be, if you enlarge it to big scale, is something like an aquatic slug more than anything. And another thing, there's many accounts in medieval lore and stuff of such creatures, and they're found all over the place. They're called lake monsters in the field of cryptozoology, and lots of places all over the world have reported these. And there are many medieval accounts of people encountering them, that they have crawled out of the water and leave a slimy trail that poisons the ground, and that if they are killed, they cut their head off, but you don't end up with a head or a skull to show off. All you end up with is teeth. So dragon's teeth or the teeth of the monster is all you get out of it, which is the only hard part that you have in slugs. So I personally think if I was going to find a good candidate, I would say that they are some kind of an unidentified, gigantic, aquatic slug, and that the humps are flotation chambers, because they are always about the same size. And the larger the animal, the more the humps. But the larger animals don't get bigger humps. The humps are limited to about a 5-foot length between the humps. And I would think that these are probably chambers that have gas. And the kind of gas, here's where it gets really interesting. The kind of gas that such a creature would be producing to fill those chambers would come from the decomposition of the vegetable matter that they would be feeding on, i.e. methane. You see where I'm going with this?
Yep, absolutely. It's like an underground submarine.
Exactly. Now, there's lots of creatures that live in very dark, murky waters that have developed a way of knowing what's around them, as well as stunning prey through electricity. Such things as the electric eel, the electric catfish, the electric gar. There's quite an array of these, really. And they can produce electricity. So if we're talking about a creature that lives in that kind of environment, these are all dark, murky, peat-laden lakes and swamps where they're found. It would be natural for them to have these flotation devices that are filled with methane, essentially. And it would also be logical if they used an electrical system for navigation for them to develop a defense mechanism in which they would belch methane and ignite it, hence the legends of fire-breathing dragons. Now, all of this is pure speculation because we haven't actually caught one, but I really think the people who are looking for some big solid thing with a skeleton and all those other features, they're completely impossible. Not going to be that. There's so many features. I've got a whole chapter about that in the Wizard's Bestiary, and if you want to really enjoy my speculations, which is really all I can claim them to be, check it out.
Well, and you talk about Bigfoot as well.
Yes. That's very interesting. The sightings of such creatures, which are found all over the northern parts of the world, are related to the taiga, the great northern forest that encircles the poles. It's huge. It's the largest single biome on the land of the earth. And it's vast and largely unexplored because it's just dense forest. It's just this dense forest, subarctic. And we have records in our paleoanthropology of creatures that were around at the same time our early hominid ancestors were. And the name that was given to them is Paranthropus, which means alongside the people. And they were larger and shaggier and vegetarian. And the reconstruction of them, they're bipedal, and the reconstructions that are done for them that you can see in museums and in books and stuff look remarkably like the descriptions and occasional fuzzy photos and the drawings that people make who have had encounters with Bigfoot or Yeti or any of the numbers of names of these creatures. So I would suspect that, again, we think we have exterminated all the other proto-hominids that were the only survivor left. And that may be the case, but not necessarily.
Right, that's right, but maybe not.
But maybe not, you know? And so I would say if there's a likely candidate to explain the Bigfoot sightings, it might very well be the descendants of Paranthropus, just the same way that we're descended from their contemporary Homo habilis and such.
What creature fascinates you the most?
Well, you know, I've got to go with dragons. I fell in love with dinosaurs as a kid.
Are they real?
Dragons. Well, you know, that covers a lot of territory. Dragons are never a single kind of animal. The drawings of dragons have such variety and such difference. In ancient times, that term was applied to everything from crocodiles to gigantic pythons and large serpents. They were all called dragons collectively. So it's a term really for large reptilian creatures. And we also know that in ancient times, people who would encounter fossilized bones of prehistoric creatures, whether they were Ice Age mammals or even as far back as dinosaurs, there was no concept of the age of the Earth in a fossilization in millions of years. If you find bones in the ground, there's no way of knowing whether that critter died last year or a million years ago. So people just assumed that these were the remains of creatures that had died fairly recently. And so there are pictures and depictions on ancient Greek pottery of dragons in which they are clearly depicting the skull of known identifiable dinosaurs that they found. The legend of the griffin comes from the particular types of dinosaurs that we call the Protoceratops and those kind of things. The legend of the Cyclops comes from mammoth skeletons.
Mm-hmm.
The skull of a mammoth looks like a human skull with a huge eye in the center of the forehead. So we have that. We have the dinosaur element. We have the giant, the large crocodiles, which the
How big were they?
The marine crocodiles in Indonesia presently range up to 25 feet or so.
Oh, man.
Larger ones over 30 feet are known. Pythons have been found over 30 feet. Anacondas have been reported like 50 feet.
Will an anaconda attack a person?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It'll
attack anything.
It can swallow one, right?
Easily. We're getting pythons, Burmese pythons in Florida now that are over 20 feet long, and they're eating deer and pigs.
Oh, my
God. They would easily eat a person if they got one.
There was a picture on the internet over on that showed a large python being opened up. They slit him, and out popped this human that it had swallowed. Now, I don't know if that was a hoax or not. But it's conceivable.
It could, because I do know of them that I've seen reports of them being cut open with a complete deer and pigs and crocodiles and alligators inside them, which is no same size as a human. So
hope nobody's eating their sandwiches right about now, right?
right. Well, there you are.
Dragons.
But then there were the giant lizards of Indonesia. We have the Komodo dragon today, but in prehistoric times, there was the Megalania, which was like a Komodo dragon, only 30 feet long. And there are still reports occasionally come from the outback in Australia of sightings of these things. There still may be around. So these would all cover it. The flying wing dragons are interesting because those came from the actual flying dragons of Indonesia that we call Dracovolans, which are these cute little flying lizards. They have wings that extend from their ribs, that they spread them out, and they sail across the air. They don't flap them to fly. But back millions of years ago, during the Permian time, over 250 million years ago, there was a whole variety of lizards that actually had real wings, that looked like those of the
Some of them would go from tree to tree, right?
Yep, exactly. And they could flap their wings and fly all over the place, and they all got wiped out, as far as we know. But it would be a very different world if they had survived. You know, I'd love it.
We're still getting reports of these huge thunderbirds. Something's up there.
That is a mystery that I really cannot begin to explain. There's only one known bird that we are aware of that's large enough to carry off a human child, and that is the lammergeier, which means lamb stealer.
Wingspan on something like that?
Well, the wingspan on one of those is like 14 feet. They're huge birds, and they're crossed between the eagle and the vulture. They fall right in between. They're called the lion eagle. They're also one of the contributors to the legend of the griffin because they have a hairy feathered mane, which is quite dramatic. And they're enormous birds, and unlike vultures, they have the talons of an eagle that can carry prey off. And what they do is that they carry bones up into the air. They don't eat flesh. They eat the marrow of bones, and they will find the bones of a dead animal and carry them way up into the air and then drop them on a rock. Or they do the same thing with turtles. So they'll split open, and then they'll come down and eat the marrow out. But there are verified reports of them carrying off human children as well as livestock. Some of these Thunderbird reports are in America, and those creatures are in Asia. So it's a mystery. The idea that birds of that size could exist in America without having a known breeding colony, without being sighted regularly, is really hard to imagine. You almost have to turn to Charles Fort's idea of some gateway between dimensions or something that things leak through. I mean, I really...
That's conceivable.
It is. It is indeed. It is indeed.
Do you get involved in that, other dimensions and things like that, in your work?
Well, sometimes things come up that bring that up, and the idea of there being portals of some sort,
yeah,
or anomalies, or you know, black holes, or something that connects our world with some other world, either in time or space, perhaps even from the past or the future, like that TV series Primeval, which we've really enjoyed. It's conceivable. I mean, we can kind of imagine that. We could work out physics that would make that possible. And so sometimes that seems the only possible explanation. This is what Charles Fort concluded, and other researchers have just said, where else can these things be coming from?
Well, that's true, too. Hey, direct us to your unicorn pictures on your site. How do we find it?
Well, go to my personal site is OberonZell.com.
All right, we got the link at coasttocoastam.com, so go ahead.
Here, OberonZell.com, and on that, if you look up the different things, there's one for Living Unicorn Interview, and it's on there.
Okay.
You should be able to find it and click onto it. It's got great interviews.
You sound like you have a passion for what you do.
I do. I'm very passionate about my work. I feel that if there's one thing that we really need to do, if somebody comes up to me, as people have sometimes asked me, well, what should I do? What do I need to do? What's the question I need to ask? I say, you need to find out what you're here for and then do it. You know, we all have to find that out. What are we here for? What are we supposed to be doing? And when you find out that, and when you do what you're supposed to be doing and really live your passion, it's really the ultimate way to be happy and fulfilled in the world, you know, and you really can't be unless you have that.
Yeah, that's true, too. Well, I want to talk about the lost civilizations and secrets of the past as well.
Right.
You talk about paradise is lost. How does a city get lost?
Well, that's the interesting thing, you know, all of this stuff about the lost civilizations. There's so many ways. I mean, Pompeii was lost because a volcano exploded.
Yeah, buried it. Yeah.
Buried it under lava, and that happens. Earthquakes happen and cover them over. If some places get abandoned or flooded or some disaster that happens, and then they just get overgrown by the swamps and the marshes that come in. So we find a lot of ancient ruins in the old world that we have to dig for under the ground, or that have been swallowed by the jungle in South America or Central America, such as the Inca ruins and the Mayan ruins. And they're there, but they've been simply lost to us because they've been swallowed up. But there's another area that I find really interesting. It's always intrigued me, and that is that, and most people don't really address this, but up until about 10,500 years ago, the world, the northern world, was covered in ice, the Great
mm-hmm.
Glaciers. And that era lasted for nearly 60,000 years. The Warm Glaciation was the last great ice age. 60,000 years. I mean, all of human history since the end of the ice age is only 10,000 years.
That's true. Stay with us. Oberon, we're going to come right back. We'll talk more about this and more about your new work, Lost Civilizations and Secrets of the Past. Plus, we'll take your phone calls and perhaps your stories. Maybe you want to spell. We'll be back.